discipline. And the word discipline has a horrible rap.
Ooh, we don't want discipline. Oh, discipline, that's old-fashioned, that's horrible. Although, has everybody heard about tiger moms? Is anybody here a tiger mom, a cougar mom, a pussycat mom, a whatever? We could have the whole animal kingdom in the audience. So, you know, that's kind of bringing discipline back. People are thinking about discipline. But what I want you to think about in terms of discipline is that the word discipline has the same Latin root as disciple. In Hebrew, horim, parents, have the same root of morah and Torah. They are, discipline is teaching. And so when we talk about setting limits, we are educating our children. What is it that we're educating our teenagers when we set a limit? Why is it so important to set limits? Certainly, limits make family life more enjoyable. If everybody just did anything they wanted, kept any bedtime they wanted, dressed however they wanted, were on a computer willy-nilly anytime they wanted, family life would be pretty chaotic. Limits allow us to all live together with each other. Setting limits also promotes healthy development. Believe it or not, there are no teenagers in the room, right? So I can say this. But we're actually smarter than they are. And we know stuff they don't know. And so left to their own devices, one of the things, if you don't already know this, about the teenagers, teenagers have a cognitive ability to see themselves as immortal and invulnerable. Bad things happen to other people, but not them. So that if they were to set their own limits, girls will say, well, I don't need to go to bed early because I'll still be able to ace the test tomorrow morning. Other girls get tired. I don't have to be careful in a chat room. Other girls attract predators, not me. I don't have to be careful when I'm driving and on the cell phone at the same time. Accidents happen to other people. Teenagers have this ability to really suspend reality. We as adults know better, and so setting limits is really a very important part of promoting their healthy development, keeping them safe. But limits also actually teach children and teenagers responsibility, leadership, and citizenship. It's how we help them become leaders of the future. You do not become a leader by having unfettered access to everything that you want. You become a leader by responding to limits and saying, I can only do what's okay for everyone, not just what's okay for me. Limits also, by the way, build compassion. Because what every time you have a rule or a parameter or a limit that a child and a teenager has to follow, what you say is that there are other people in the world who matter too. It's not just about you. You have to think beyond yourself, and it helps you to learn to delay gratification. So that's all just, you know, why we want to do this, that you're all in the room because you do want to do it, and you want to know how to do it effectively. Now, why is it so darn hard? Why is this so difficult? And first, it's hard because which one of us went into parenting, had children, sat there in labor and delivery saying, I can't wait to make rules. Oh, I can't wait till she grows up and I can say no. That's not what made us want to parent. It's not what engages us in parenting. It's not what's spiritual or exciting about parenting. You know, what's exciting are the yeses in parenting, not the no's. And then the other thing is that it's not easy because when you do set a limit, which child says, Mother, thank you for a bedtime. I really appreciate that I got that extra sleep. Needed that. Thanks a lot. Dad, glad you told me to get off the computer. I heard that stuff I was looking at was really not good for my mental health. Thank you very much. Kids don't thank you when you set limits. You get responses when they're little that are, you know, I hate you, I'm running away from home. And when they're bigger, you get responses like, I hate you, you're the worst parent in the world. Which, by the way, if you do not hear sometime in your daughter's adolescence that you are the worst parent, that every other parent, fill in the blank. You know, bless their daughter, you're not doing your job. And just a little word of advice, by the way, when you hear that every other parent lets, check it out. 9 times out of 10, it's not true. And you'll find that there are other parents who are setting the same rules and regulations and that your daughter's not sharing that with you. One issue with always saying yes to teenagers, if we do it, is that in essence we then rob them of their opportunity to be responsible. If we always give them everything they want, then we don't give them opportunities to practice self-control, and that's so important in part of their adolescent development. I want to focus on what limits to set, how to set them, when to set them, so that they're effective. Now, first of all, totally depends on the audience what limits you're going to set. Years ago, I worked at Long Island Jewish Medical Center where we had one-way mirrors for training our therapy trainees in family therapy. And one of our trainees was about to have an intake session with an Orthodox family from Brooklyn and had the chairs all set up, brings the family in. The team, myself included, is behind a one-way mirror. My co-supervisor was a Roman Catholic therapist, and myself, and a number of other therapists. And the family comes in, they have a teenage daughter, they're from Borough Park, and their number one complaint sucks. Why does she have to wear the red knee socks? And why aren't they over the knee? And how come she can't wear the blue knee socks like everybody else with the black knee socks? What is it with the socks? Now, imagine the Roman Catholic therapist and the secular therapist behind the window. They're watching this saying, the family's crazy. What is it with knee socks? Who cares about knee socks? And I had to acculturate them and say, in this community, those red socks are a major, major issue. The week later, by the way, we saw a Hindu family where the teenage daughter refused to wear traditional Indian dress, a sari, when she went to visit her grandmother, or she would wear a sari, notice the parallel between the knee socks, with kids, with bright pink kids sneakers. And finally, the other therapist could get it, that, oh, now we understand the knee sock issue. It's really a culture, and even though they don't think Judaism is a unique, exotic religion, Borough Park was the equivalent of this Hindu family. So there's no one, I can't tell you, here are the limits you should set. Limits are things that are unique to your family. But the one thing I can tell you is that as parents, you have a right, and I would even say an obligation, to set limits. When I speak to parents of younger children, I get amazing questions like, Captain Ovid, is it okay to have a mealtime? Yes. Of course it's okay. You're the parent. You get to decide what meals are like in your house. And if you want everyone to sit at the table now, if a parent says, Captain Ovid, is it okay to have a 5-hour, 12-course meal for my 2-year-old? I'm going to say no. 2-year-olds can't sit. And by the way, don't try to have a 5-hour, 12-course Shabbos lunch with your teenage daughter, because she also does not want to deal with you for 5 hours, you and your friends and all adult conversation. She also is going to need time with her chevra, with her her peer group. But you get to make the rules as a parent, and you get to say, our house is a house where we have family game nights, where we have these rules about TV or computer. We are not a family that children go independently on vacation without their parents before they married, 18, love you, or, you know, of voting age or whatever. You get to set those limits and make those rules. I'll give you tips about how to do it effectively, but in terms of what, there isn't any one thing that's off limits, but you also have to think very clearly about what is it I want to teach. And in terms of choosing your battles, you don't want to regiment your teenager's life so minutely that every minute of every day, every decision she makes is made by you. Because teenage years are times when they need to develop a little bit of their own style. And maybe knee socks are okay with you. Maybe hairstyles okay. You know, maybe there are places, even within dress, where you have wiggle room, and other places you say, no, we don't. That's something we don't do. And you have to think both in terms of the quantity of limits that you're setting, you know, that you're not regimenting everything, but also what are the things that are negotiable and what are the things that you can set up cooperatively. You have to decide sometimes which lessons are most important to you, which ones are just, for whatever reason, really, really matter. And it could be safety, it could be a moral or Torah value that's so important to you that you say, listen, I know other girls do X, but this is very important to me. It's so critical to who we are as a family. I have to tell you a funny story here about values. Because recently, I was doing some research that I did for Yeshiva University, and I was in middle schools asking girls and boys to fill out questionnaires about social relationships. For the first time ever this year, we included in the questionnaires questions about you, about parents. And the questions read things like, my parents think it's important to include everyone. My parents think that you have to stay out of other people's business, even if somebody is getting into trouble. My parents think, it was questions about parents' attitudes towards their children's social lives. I have to tell you that in droves, kids started raising their hands and coming up to whoever was giving out the survey, saying, I don't know how to answer question 8. I don't know what my parents think about that. I don't know how to answer question 10. I don't know what my parents feel about. So I started, wondering, how is it that when I speak to parents, parents all say, I value friendship and I value children getting along well, but the children don't know that. And then I went home that weekend. This is a boy story, but I believe it could happen with girls too. I went home that weekend, and one of our sons was coming home for Shabbos from college, and I was tying up the newspapers to recycle them. And wise guy that he is, he sees me tying up the newspapers, and he says, oh, would you become eco-mom? And I said, what do you mean eco-mom? I was recycling. I've always recycled. He says, I didn't know that recycling was a big deal for you. Like, I didn't know you really care about the environment. And I'm thinking, we always have a bag of bottles to take back to the store. I've been recycling newspaper. I have cans all over the kitchen lined up when I cook to go in the recycling bin. How do you not know that this matters to me? And I put those two things together and I said, we live our Torah values and we think our children pick them up. We think they know this is important to us. And I realized, by the way, that the same son who was teasing me about eco-mom didn't tease me about, oh, what are you, candle lighting mom all of a sudden? What are you, Shomer Shabbos all of a sudden? What are you, Torah mom? No, he knows that. Why? Because not only when you're raising children, not only do you live your Torah values, you talk them. You educate them in your Torah values. When they're little, you say, oh honey, that's muktzah, we don't touch that on Shabbos. When you're in the grocery store, you say, no, sweetheart, that doesn't have a heksher, we don't eat that. So those Torah values we talk about. But we have to think about the lessons that we're teaching our children. If we think it's really important, it's not enough to say, well, doesn't she see that I dress with tzniut? Doesn't she know it's important to me? If we're not also speaking that language and educating directly, not just through limits, but saying, this is something I value and that's important, then they're not going to know that. If we don't say, I have secular passions and interests, and I think watching some TV or going to movies is fine, but I also think that there's a limit on what I want to bring into my mind and my brain, and some stuff out there is just such garbage. If we're not saying it to our children, they don't know where we value. Okay. So when do we set limits? So here's the bad part of the news story if you have teenagers, because really you set limits early. Like if you wait, I actually, it's a true story. I had a family come to me with a 14-year-old daughter in my private practice and said, we don't know what's happened. Things are really terrible. And I said, well, what was things like before then? She was fine. She was lovely. She was wonderful. Now everything is a fight. Everything is an argument. I turned to the 14-year-old and I said, well, what's going on that, your parents say everything is an argument? And the 14-year-old girl said, well, up until now, they said yes to everything. If you say yes to everything to a child, all the way up until their teen years, and the first time they experience no is as a teenager, you're in for trouble. So if you have younger children, start. But it's never too late. Don't worry. If you haven't said no yet, you still have time to set limits and to say no. So if you haven't done it early in a child's life, then you have to use some facts of human nature in terms of how you set limits. First of all, limits should never be set when you are losing it. They should never be set when your buttons are pushed. That's when we set those crazy limits like you're grounded for life, you will never use the telephone again, you will not set foot into a car until you are 87 years old. That's when we say the crazy things. So use delay tactics. If you are at your wit's end, one of the best things you can do as a parent is give yourself time and say, I am very upset about the current situation, and I need to think about what is going to be my response. If your mom say, I need to talk to dad, if your dad say, mom and I need to talk, give yourself time. It does two things. First of all, it avoids you saying limits that you can't live with, that your child, your daughter can't live with, that you can't make happen. It also models the best crisis management, conflict resolution for your daughter. It shows. You don't have to decide things in the moment. You can take a deep breath. I know someone's talking about stress tonight. You know, you can kick back, take a step back and say, wait a minute, I can do this. And by the way, if your body posture is this when you're setting a limit, this is incendiary. If your weight is on your front foot, even if your finger's not sticking out, if your weight is on your front foot, you are pushing for a fight. You are backing someone into the corner. Eva Feinler, an anger management expert, reminds parents, kick back. Look how much different I look if I'm like this and I'm talking to you about what you did last night than if I'm like this. It's just such a little shift. But make sure that your weight, instead of being on your front foot when you're talking to a child about something they did wrong, kick back and put your weight on your back foot. It changes the dialogue. Totally changes the dialogue because you're not in their face and you give them some space. By the way, if it's a child who's going to come at you, like a little one, teenagers don't, little one, but if your weight's on your back foot, you also can make, you know, you can move faster. So for little kids, that works. If you haven't set limits early in your child's life, the other way to think about it is set limits early in the process. Again, another funny, true story that's a little bit son-daughter. Because of being in private practice, I hear lots of things. And so many, many years ago, a lovely Jewish high school girl from an all-girls school came to me. You can tell how many years ago it was because she had spent spring break or winter break in Florida with friends. And she came to me and said, I don't know what to do, Dr. Novick. I usually give my dad my film to develop. Do you know how many years ago this was? I can't give him the film because he'll see stuff that I can't have him see. I was okay during spring break, but there were guys sleeping in my room. And there was drugs and drinking. And I didn't do any of that stuff. I stayed okay. I was very uncomfortable a lot of times. I kept myself safe. But my dad can't see these pictures. I went home that night. I think my oldest son was 10, 11. And I said, 7 years from now, you're going to come to me. And you were going to ask me if you and your buds could go away on vacation. And the answer is no. And you know who came to me at 18? And I said, I answered the question already. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, no, you don't remember, but I told you when you were 11 that you don't go on vacation solo until you're an independent adult. But as long as you live in my house and you're in high school, you travel with us or you don't travel. That's it. End of story. So early in the process, if not 11 years ahead of time, things that you can anticipate, that you can make rules about ahead of time, before the new computer, the wireless, comes into your house, before your daughter gets a laptop, that's the time to negotiate usage. Before you get cable, that's when to talk about how much TV you can watch and where. Before you're in the mall, I'm pointing to you because you right mentioned clothing, the decisions about what you can and cannot buy, that has to happen before you're in front of the Gap or the store in the mall. It's much easier for us to accept limits when we don't have that temptation right in front of us. So we want to make those rules and those limits, whenever possible, ahead of time. There are a couple of phenomena that actually marketers and communication experts know about human nature that we can use when we're working with our teenagers to help them accept and be reasonable in discussions about limits. We know that the human brain prefers starting to stopping. We like yes commands better than no commands. And the human brain also hates a vacuum. So if we tell a child no TV, that's a much harder thing for them to follow than if we say, instead of TV, we'd like you to work on your craft project, or this is scrapbooking time, or this is time for, I don't want to say studying, because that's like a really hard, you know, no TV, study instead. It's like, you know, for me, say no chocolate, eat broccoli. Not exactly going to be equated. But thinking not about just saying, don't stop, you can't. Think about saying what you can do instead. I prefer you do, or I'm asking you to do X instead of Y. The perception of choice shortcuts the human brain's immediate response to a no. When somebody says to you, or immediate response to command, when someone says to you, study, the first response to imperative commands is the neurological equivalent of a hand on the hip. Make me. You know, someone says to you, diet, make me. Somebody says to you, don't wear that, you know, comb your hair, make me. That's the neurologic equivalent, hands on hip, I'm not going to do it. But we short circuit that neurology the minute we give the illusion of choice. The illusion of choice is, are you studying math or nothing? Now, there's no question there that you're studying. The question is it math or Navi? And amazingly, even we can do this to ourselves. You can try it on yourself. It feels better to say, okay, am I going to, vacuum the downstairs or the upstairs? You're vacuuming. It just feels better that, okay, I have some choice about this. Also, by the way, there's something called the Primat principle. It was first studied with pigeons. It's been demonstrated with all other species. Its fancy scientific name is called Grandma's Rule. Grandma's Rule is that you can increase the likelihood that you'll do something by rewarding yourself afterwards. It's Grandma's Rule. Yeah, you'll do the hard stuff first if some good stuff is coming afterwards. In translation, Grandma's Rule is if you eat your dinner, then you can have the cookies. That's Grandma's Rule. So in setting limits with our daughters, we also can help them understand the Prenec principle because, again, what do teenagers say? I promise you, I'll study after. Just let me watch these 10 more shows, and then I'll study. No, just 3 more minutes on the phone with my girlfriend, then I'll take out the garbage. It's always, they're always asking to do the opposite of the Prenec principle. Let me do the fun stuff first, then I promise, I'll do the horrible stuff. We have to help them understand that's not human nature. That doesn't work. You absolutely can have some choices. You can do that, but do the hard stuff first. Then you can have access to the other stuff that you want. The language that we use in setting limits is also almost as powerful as body language. So you can have language that is just as, you know, putting you up to the wall as stepping forward and finger pointing. You know, if you say you're going to do this no matter what, I'm the boss, I make the rules in this house, that's it. You can't tell me, your mother or father, what you're going to do. You've now thrown down the gauntlet. That is not the language of collaboration. That's not the language of reason. That's the language of hierarchy. And by the way, one of the developmental tasks of adolescence is to fight the man, is to fight society's control over you, is to break free from the yoke of your parents and become an independent, functioning human being. And so if you use the language of, I'm your king, you're my subject, you're going to get revolted. If instead you use the language of benevolent monarchy, I always think of parents as benevolent monarchs, you know best, but you don't rule with an iron fist, you rule out of love and care. And you're happy to entertain petitions from the commoners, you know, from your loyal subjects, to hear what it is that they think. And if a petition makes sense, then you're happy to use, again, your kingly or queenly rule to make it so, to make it happen. But you do want to operate from strength. We never want either to use the language of begging and pleading. I'm asking you, would you please do this? How many times do I have to tell you? You really have to study. It's making me miserable. But you don't want to set limits with a whining, arguing, pleading style. Lastly, and then I'll open to your comments and questions and perhaps some specific examples. When we're setting, there's something that was missing on that last slide, and it's the most important point. Collaboratively. There's a wonderful approach that has been heralded by Stuart Avlon and Ross Green. Their first book, I wasn't such a big fan of, it's called the Ross Green's first book, it's Green with an E at the end, was called The Explosive Child. His latest book is Lost at School. It's mostly about school, but I highly recommend it to parents only because he actually has dialogues between teachers and students about setting limits that are purely collaborative, and it's a lovely language. You can also, you can Google Ross Green and look at his website on collaborative problem solving, and you can see little video clips of him doing some of these problem solving with kids. Of course, these are acted vignettes. Real children and teenagers aren't so cooperative. But what's the idea behind collaborative problem solving? The idea is that, and to me it makes so much sense with teenagers, that when we sit down with a daughter and say, this is the way it's going to be because I say so, we not only open the possibility of revolt, but we don't really engage our daughters in problem solving. But if we sit with a daughter and we say something along the lines of, I know that you like to watch TV, and I like you to get sleep and be on top of your studies. Right now, the way your TV watching isn't working for me. It might be working for you, but it's not working for me. Could we make a time to talk to see if we could figure out a way that would work for both of us? And then you'd sit down together and problem solve. And you, not at the moment that her favorite TV show is on, not when you're saying, that's it, turn it off, now we've got to sit down and talk about it, but in a time when it's not an issue and it's not a problem, to sit down together and say, let's think about what are some of the possibilities. We might even talk about, what is all the TV watching about? You know, is it because you're unhappy or you're lonely or you're miserable? Is there a reason that you watch TV so much and you're not calling your friends anymore? Maybe we could get to the bottom of what the TV watching is about. But even if we don't do that, could we put our heads together and think about what could work for both of us? In one such dialogue, I read about it, though this is not a case I worked with, the mom was very upset about the number of times that she would have to ask her daughter to help out with household responsibilities. And the daughter was constantly asking mom for rides here, there, and everywhere, and would be quite incensed if mom wouldn't drive her someplace. And so after they had a conversation together, mom said, you know, I feel like you're asking me to be your chauffeur. And I would really actually be quite happy to be your chauffeur if you would be, you know, kind of my Sunday morning maid. If you would give me 2-3 hours on a Sunday and give me a hand with the house, the rest of the week, I would so gladly drive you everywhere. And the daughter said, that's all it would take? What would I need to do Sunday mornings? And because they'd done this collaboratively, they came up with the task that needed to be done. And I think the mom, even as kind of a joke, got a little chauffeur's cap and, you know, said, great, you did such a great job Sunday morning. You know, I'm yours for the week. Tell me where you need to go. But the point was that it was done in the spirit of collaboration, not I made the rules, I made the chart. We do this with younger children. With younger children, we can say, here are your chores, here's your responsibility. It's developmentally more appropriate, although I started using this collaborative stance with 6-year-olds in my office with amazing, just amazing results. The things that they say and that they're willing to agree to when they're put in charge are far beyond anything that the teachers or the parents want them to do. When I ask even 6-year-olds, but certainly older kids, what do you think would be a reasonable way to solve this problem so that your mom could be happy and you could be happy? They astound me at how rigid limits they'll set on themselves more than the parents would have. So I urge you to try a collaborative stance. But it's also important to balance setting limits with catching and crediting and celebrating the times that your child does respond to limits. You know, for everything that we are pulling our hair out over, there may be 10 things that our children are doing, sometimes happily, gladly, and amazingly. And we need to balance that. We need not to be the parent that is constantly saying, no, don't stop. We also need to be saying, that's just the way I like it. That's a terrific job. I love it when you, and by the way, the phrases I'm using are too vague. If you say to teenagers, that's a terrific job, I don't know what's a terrific job. You have to say, you did such a beautiful job setting the table, or I'm really impressed with how you took responsibility for getting that book report done, not only on time, but a day early. You have to be specific about what you're complimenting and what you're excited about. But do that. And finally, you have to create an environment where it pays to respond to limits. And I'm going to close with this amazing story about a teenage girl who knew that from her parents, and they learned the power of it in a difficult way. 14-year-old girl tells her parents, maybe 15, tells her parents that she is spending the night at a girlfriend's house for a sleepover. These parents, by the way, had told their daughter that if ever in her life she found herself in a place where she felt unsafe, no matter where it was or what time of day or night, that she was to call them and they would come and get her. No questions asked. Not no consequences, but no questions asked. They would come and get her. 3 a.m, they get a phone call. I'm in New York at an after-hours club. She's 14, 15 years old. People have been drinking. I think they're doing drugs. And they want to get in a car now and go someplace else. And I don't think it's safe. The parents said, put the bartender on the phone, spoke to the bartender, said, our daughter is 15 years old, do not let her leave your sight. We are on the way. We lived in Long Island. This was in Manhattan, 3 a.m. You can go pretty fast on the LIE. They scoot into Manhattan. 25 minutes later, they are scooping up their 14-year-old daughter. And all they told her on the way home was, you did the right thing. We are so proud of you for calling us. We'll have to talk tomorrow about, you know, all the other parts, but right now tonight, we want to thank you for listening to us. We want to tell you we'll do it again in a minute. If it ever happens again that you find yourself not safe, not you did the right thing, and we are so proud of you. Think about how the restraint it took those parents not to say, we ain't gonna kill you. The next morning, they sat down quietly and calmly and said, you know, what do you think needs to happen? And she said, I probably need to be grounded for a while, right? And it happened to be a big school event was coming up. And she said, I probably need to miss that. Again, she said it. And I said, yeah, you do. You do. But we're really proud of what you did. So it's not easy. The big ones are just as hard as the little ones. But we have to keep at it and keep doing it. And it's a learning process. And again, remember that every minute that this family could do that because they had a relationship. If your children don't care about what you think, then your limits don't matter. If your children don't care
just wanted the presenters and our audience to know that the sessions were going to fill a lot of time, even though we started a little late. And the sessions are 50 minutes and will conclude at 9:10. The sessions will conclude at 9:10. That's about 14 minutes now. Thank you so much. At that point, we'll announce all the sessions and locations for the second session. Thank you.
So if you don't matter to your child, if how you feel about them, if the withdrawal of your approval doesn't mean anything to them, then your limits don't mean anything to them. And the way that you enforce your limits with things like time out or grounding or loss of privileges are useless and they're worthless. The most powerful tool that you have in your parenting is yourself. The thing that has to matter most to your children is your love, your admiration, and your approval. And so that's what you need to be building to set effective limits. I think I'd like to open the floor up to your comments and questions in the 10 minutes that we have left so that I can best address your needs. Yes.
So you spoke earlier about the need to set limits in advance of the things actually happening, in advance of the computer, in advance of the telephone, in advance of the cable. Unfortunately, I think most of us here are probably at the stage we already have those things available to our child. They are teenagers. Now,
so, first of all, there. Even though you have them, God bless technology, it just keeps changing. So you may already have the phone, but the next phone is going to have 10 new bells and whistles on it. I know that when we added text to our plan, I set a limit with one of our children was still in high school at the time that we added text, and I said, okay, texting is coming onto the plan now. Here's the parameters. If I see a record of texting between the hours of 8 and 6 when you were in school, your phone's gone. Now, I set that before texting was live on his phone. He had a phone, but that was a new technology. But how do you set, and by the way, I then had to, this is the other piece. If you're going to set limits, you have to do the hard work of making them happen. For 3 months, I read the cell phone bill. date stamp on every little text message, hundreds of them, to make sure that they weren't happening between 8 and 6. After 3 months, I felt I could spot check if, you know, we were good. But let's say a new problem arises with something that's already in your house. How do you deal with that? I would deal with that, again, collaboratively, and I would sit somebody down and say, not at the moment that you're heated, not at the moment they're heated, but say, we need to talk about this because it's not working for me. I'm not comfortable with it. And again, that's so why relationship is so important, because the last thing I want is a teenager who says, well, what do I care that it's not working for you? It's my phone. Get off my bed. I want it to matter that when you sit down with your teenage daughter and say, this is upsetting to me, this is not working to me, they say, oh, I'm sorry, Daddy. You know, oh, all right, well, what are you saying, Mom? But at least they're concerned that you're concerned. And then you have to have a hard conversation about what you do about it. I will tell you, just in terms of technology, that I think schools are moving towards education, more education about some of the, you alluded to computers and cell phones, so does your question relate a little bit to technology things? Yeah. I am absolutely amazed at how stupid the generation that is so cyber smart is. They are remarkably stupid. I had a 14-year-old girl who was about to be brought up on charges for harassment and stalking for sending 300 text messages an hour to a peer. And she said to me, I'm not joking, she said, well, nobody can trace them, I deleted them. They're not on my phone anymore, I deleted them. And then 2 weeks ago, I was visiting a Jewish high school in another city, and there was going around in that high school, a student was sending emails to all the other students in the school pretending to be someone else. In other words, under an alias and saying things that they knew, and nobody knew who this person was. And they were all, the high school, Jewish high school, a posh, competitive, you know, SKA-like, smart high school, and they're all saying, well, nobody could ever trace it. You know, the guy took it, we think we know who it is, but he wiped his hard drive. Nobody could find it. And I said, you know, are you the FBI or the CIA? Are you the anti-terrorism unit of the U.S.? You think that a hard drive can be wiped clean? If you do something online that is illegal, that is dangerous, it can and will be found. The issues of technology that I find kids desperately need education about is permanence. They really don't understand the permanence. And permanence both in terms of legality and of how it's going to affect their, you know, that anything they do online is there forever. And so when they're applying to high schools, when they're applying to colleges, when they're going for jobs, people are looking at their old Facebook pages. At their own, and that's the other issue is privacy, that they believe in passwords. You know, and the way that us old people, like, don't think anything is totally safe and you can break into things, because I still live in a world of, like, a box, a safe, something that can be broken. There isn't a safe that's uncrackable, so I don't believe that there's an internet password that's uncrackable. But kids believe in the internet as, well, I have a password protector. I have a firewall. I have a this. Yeah, there are hackers that can get, there are people who can get around that. So I think they need education about it. And in terms of setting limits, we just have to sit with them and process it and collaboratively talk about it and come to things that are, they're going to be very hard decisions and very hard discussions, because they're never going to want to take a step back and use less. They always want more technology. Yeah.
One is, my daughter is not quite a teenager. She's going to be 11 years old, but I want to start early because she's a very strong personality. And today, a 10 or 11-year-old is like a 50 or 16-year-old was in my generation. The access to what she has access to, you know, song lyrics, she watched Degrassi, Boiling Point, when I'm not watching, I mean, certain, what's available to younger children is like a teenager years ago. She's already going through seeing things now that thankfully she's not a teenager yet, but before she gets to that point, before she's a teenager, what are we going to do now over the next few years to prevent?
Well,
because
you know,
a very strong-willed person, and, you know.
You know, it's tempting to just say blindfold, you know, earplugs, because the reality is that in our you know, in our world, if you happen to drive on a bus or see what ride, you know, you can think, okay, I'm going to shelter my child. But I will tell you some of the things that, you know, I see on the side of New York City buses and on the subway platforms are pretty risque. Never mind, you know, Times Square billboards as cleaned up as Times Square has gotten. You know, it's there are things that kids are exposed to. So I think that's where we need, again, to say, here's what our family believes. Here's what our values are. Yes, you are. I had this issue where a school, well, I don't want to say anything about it, but basically what I said to the school was, we don't teach kashrut by burning down McDonald's. We drive past McDonald's and we teach children that we don't eat there because we answer to a higher standard. And we have to do the same with kind of the cesspool that our kids are swimming in terms of media and exposure, and say, look, there are song lyrics that, if you listen to them carefully, are really so degrading to women and so negative in terms of their view of human beings and relationships.
There are 5 minutes remaining to this session.
That we don't want to have them in our home, even if we like to be, if we're going to look for something else. We're going to look for something that makes us feel better about ourselves. Those are the discussions that you have to have now, as well as discussions which are very, very difficult, both from the preteen through the teen years, about what your family allows vis-a-vis what the families around you allow. It is very, very difficult to be the only girl in the school whose family doesn't have, I don't know, pick anything, cable or internet. If that's a community that uses, you know, those kinds of things, it's hard to be the family that says. It's very difficult to be the one who doesn't wear pants if everybody does wear pants. It's very hard to be the one who is not allowed to have sleepovers at the age of 11 when everybody else is, to be the last one or the... On the other hand, children don't die from it. You know, having a strict parent, having a family that has rules, it isn't horrific. You know, it's not going to ruin your life as much as children will say it's going to ruin your life. You do have to, as a parent, think about what are the social consequences of the decisions you make. But you also can have impact that way. You can say, because I don't feel comfortable with the movies that people watch at that home for sleepovers, we're going to have sleepovers at our home. Sometimes you have to bite the bullet and do the harder parenting if you want to have greater supervision. The age of cell phones, by the way, I think has made our parenting much harder. Before cell phones, I know we all think it's a great convenience, you know where your children are. No, you don't. You have no idea where they are. Before cell phones, if they said, I'm going to be at Shira's house, you called Shira's house. Hi, could I speak to, you know, Naomi? And if Naomi didn't get on the phone, you knew she wasn't at Shira's house. Now you call her cell phone. She says, I'm at Shira's house. Is she? I don't know. We don't know where she is. Also, before cell phones, before she would go over to Naomi's house, Naomi would call her. You would answer the phone, oh, hi, Naomi. And then you would talk to Daniela. And then you would talk to Devorah. And then you would talk to Tzippi. And you knew, oh, these are the 6 girls that are hanging out together at that house. Let me just call Naomi's mom and make sure that there's adequate supervision. Now, all of this happens with us out of the equation because the calls aren't coming to our home phone. They're coming to their cell phones. Girls, it's a little bit easier. I said before, I'm the mother of boys. You try to ask boys, who are you going bowling with? Guys. Which guys? Usual. Where are you going? Out. It's like grilling the CIA. Girls, you may get a conversation, but you only get what they want you to hear. And the calls aren't coming into you, so it makes it really hard. Les, somebody had a question in the back? Yeah. It's a very, very good question. I'm going to repeat the question. If you have several children, one is very different, and they don't want to adhere to the rules of SNEAS, and it affects the whole house. So the first part of your question was easy. So let me do the easy part first. What if you have several children, and they're very different? So it's really, this is another thing that we should be starting early. We should be starting earlier in our houses to communicate to our children that equal does not mean the same. That fair does not mean the same. It would be very unfair to have a 12-year-old wear diapers because your 2-year-old does. Just tell them that when they say, no, they get more. It would be very unfair to make a 16-year-old go to bed the same time as an 8-year-old. The Kutzker-Rebbe said the greatest inequality in the world is treating different people exactly the same. So we have to respect the uniqueness of each and every neshama. I think also that the Breslov or someone said each child's a nigun, and we have to nurture the nigun of each child. You know, every child is different, and we have to help them understand that just because your brother or your sister gets X doesn't mean that you get X, you get what you need. Every child gets what they need. Now the hard part of the question. And it could be sneas, it could be Shabbos, it could be kashrut, it could be friends, it could be technology, it could be anything. What do you do when one member of the family is holding in a different place than the family hashkafa? And it's very, very hard. There's no one answer. I suggest, again, that it's very helpful to speak with schools, with rebbeim, with people that you trust. But sometimes it's sitting down and having family meetings and talking about that for this person, it's very, you know, some things are very hard for them. Or this is where they are right now, and we hope that they will be different, but this is not what we believe. But it's our brother, it's our sister, we still love them. So finding, you know, Dr. Pelkovitz, my colleague, always talks about one of the hardest things for kids is when they feel the family bumper sticker has no room for them. You know, if the family bumper sticker is Lakewood or bust, then you're not a learner. If the family bumper sticker is Siyut is us, and you're just a little more, you know, hip, modern, and edgy, and out there. So one of our challenges is, can we broaden our bumper stickers a little bit to make sure every child in our family feels loved, wanted, and nurtured, but at the same time, we keep what is important to us as families. Thank you all very much. Enjoy the rest of your evening.